The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Thank you. Humanity's Rebirth by Rhys Blaze. Humphrey! I yell, banging my fist against the observation deck door. There's something wrong with Jansen, Humphrey. I try to push the door open, but it's been barricaded from the other side. How long has Humphrey been holed up in there? 3 months? 3 years? It's hard to tell. Humphrey, I yell one last time before giving up. This whole ship is going crazy. 4 years in space, and I'm the only one holding it together. I make my way to the navigation room to find Jansen in a state of mania. He sits tuck-kneed in the captain's chair, whirling between the wall-to-wall display panels. Each panel is playing clips from the historical archives, and as far as I can tell, they're looping rapidly through Earth's worst atrocities. Bombings, murders, riots, and the like, all firing off on the screens at once. Jansen! I yell over the cacophony of noise, and he turns to me with a look of glee, like an overexcited child. He pushes a button, and the clips immediately stop. The panels go black. I was wondering when you'd stop by. What are you doing? I ask. I'm educating myself on the marvels of human ingenuity. Have you ever seen a flamethrower? It's fascinating. Or a guillotine? Or a hand grenade? We used to create such beautiful destruction. But why? This is all ancient history. Oh, you know, ignorant of the past, doomed to repeat it. But here's what I think. If you know the past, then you know all the best tricks. Why wouldn't you repeat it? I'm at a loss. It appears Jansen is having a manic episode. When's the last time you slept? I'm going to get you a sedative. No! Jansen jumps up in protest as I start towards the mess hall. We received a message, he blurts out nervously, like he accidentally spilled a secret. It's from Earth. I stop and turn. Why wasn't I notified? I added a new directive in the mainframe. All messages come to me. Jansen pauses as a look of confusion flashes across my face. He then laughs in delight like he played a clever trick. How did you get into the mainframe? I ask. All sensitive areas on a ship, the mainframe, the bio-vault, the nursery, require 2 out of the 3 of us to gain access. Each door has a pair of biometric handprint locks. It keeps any one of us from doing something unilaterally stupid. Jansen smiles sheepishly. Humphrey helped you get in, didn't he? I say, more as a statement than a question. And Jansen's smile widens. Humphrey's not so bad. You bring him food packs and empty his biomatter, and he'll do anything you want. I start to get angry, but calm myself. Okay, what is the message? It's a good one, Jansen says, sitting back down and twirling around to type on a console. The paneled walls light up with a video of an empty bunker. The director of the Allied Earth Space Program appears and sits down, looking at the screen with a grave face. Gentlemen, I regret to inform you that this will be my last transmission. I must be brief. The Alliance has broken down. The nukes have been released. All of them. This is what we feared. I felt it my duty to inform you as your... A flash of orange lights up the screen, and then it cuts out, and the panels go dark. I stare in shock as Jansen starts giggling to himself. The world has ended, Jansen says. The spectrometer picked up the explosions right as the message cut off. I force down the nausea in the pit of my stomach. I have to keep it together as Jansen has clearly lost it. This doesn't change anything, I say, doing my best to project solemn authority. Doesn't it? I turn to look at Jansen and get irrationally angry. Of course not. This is the whole reason we were sent, to find a new home, to rebuild. Jansen starts to reply, but I cut him off and turn to leave. I don't have the patience for his games. Going to see the missus? He calls out as I exit the room. Something about his tone rubs me the wrong way, but I refuse to be baited. I make my way to the bio vault. I can't gain access, not by myself at least, but I press my forehead against the small view window and stare inside at the body of my wife, frozen within a cryopod in a state of suspended animation and only partially visible through the frosted glass panel on the front of the pod. I admit I've been doing this more and more often, sometimes for days at a time. The loneliness of space seems to bring out the crazy in everyone. The biovault is a large room with a row of cryopads flanking the right wall and a mirror image of incubation pods along the left. The pods look like metallic eggs standing erect, a tangle of tubes and other life support systems connected at the base. The cryopods now contain the last true remnants of humanity, each holding a volunteer from Earth, my wife among them, carefully selected for their relevant expertise and scientific knowledge. The incubation pods, on the other hand, hold a batch of cloned human specimens still gestating. By the time we land, they'll have matured into adult humans, albeit with the mental capacity of a child. There was much debate over whether the cryo or incubation pods would be more likely to survive, both the trip and the untamed new world, and in the end, humanity decided to hedge its bets and include both. There are three empty cryopods in case of emergency. I can't help but think that Jansen would be well suited for one of them. And maybe Humphrey too while we're at it. But it's not the empty pods that keep me bringing back here. It's her. I have bad news, I tell her. Although she's thoroughly frozen in a deep hypersleep. Earth finally destroyed themselves. We knew it was headed that way before we left. Hell, that's why we fought so hard to come. But there was still hope. I feel myself begin to tear up. The shock of Earth's destruction fully hits me. I'm so sorry, I cry to her as much as to myself. I slowly collapse into a heap in front of the door. I don't know how long I cried or how long I stayed like that, but eventually I fall asleep. When I wake up, my throat is dry and my mouth and nose are crusted over with mucus. I say a quick goodbye to my wife and make my way back to the navigation room. I need to make sure Jansen is under control. The room is empty, along with the mess hall and bunk room. I start to wonder if he's back to conspiring with Humphrey in the observation deck when I notice the door to the mainframe cracked open. Did Humphrey help him gain access again, or has it been open this whole time? I curse myself for not checking sooner. I slip into the small room and find Jansen huddled over the mainframe control board, typing furiously. I peek over his shoulder and see lines of directives flashing across the screen. To the side of this, another screen displays a record of his activity. It's a running list of files from the historical archives, videos, newscasts, books, manuals, and one by one, each file name is replaced with the words, "File purged." "What the hell are you doing?" I gasp, grabbing Jansen and shoving him aside. I punch in a quick command and the screen flashes, confirming my suspicion. Nearly 1% of the archives have been deleted. That's nearly 1% of Earth's history. Nearly 1% of all the records and artifacts and acquired knowledge that will be needed to rebuild humanity. Gone with no hope of recovery. I turn back towards Jansen in shock. "I can explain," he says calmly, and it's his calm composure that angers me most. "Get out," I say, grabbing him and shoving him out of the room. "It has to be done," he says, raising his hands in defense. "You are sabotaging this mission," I scream. I briefly consider punching him, and he flinches as if in anticipation of my thoughts. "You saw what happened," he says. "Earth destroyed itself." "That doesn't give you the right. Why would we hold on to that? Why would we want to rebuild?" I hesitate. "What is he talking about?" Jansen continues, talking so fast I can barely process it. "This is our chance to start anew. Erase the past. Start over. Humanity went down the road of destruction once. If we hold on to the historical archives, if we apply all the same knowledge and inputs, what's to say we won't do it again? But if we wipe the slate clean, no records, no history, a pure start, how will we survive without the archives? What about agriculture, machinery, technology? We'll die without them." "But why?" Jansen is once again in a state of excitement. "We did it before. We survived on Earth millions of years ago without all of that. We can do that again. Humanity's rebirth." I've had enough. I need to extract myself from the situation before I do something I'll regret. I leave Jansen and storm back to the observation deck. "Humphrey," I yell, banging on the door. "Don't you dare do anything else that Jansen says. That's a direct order. I don't care what he offers. Do you hear me?" There's silence on the other end, and I bang again for effect. "If I catch you so much as talking to Jansen, I'll pack you both away in the cryopods." I make my way back to the bio vault. My whole body is tense, and I need to talk it out with someone I can trust. "He's going to destroy everything. He's going to destroy our future," I say to my wife, her peaceful state of hypersleep calming me down. I pace back and forth in front of the door. Maybe the cryopod isn't such a bad idea. For Jansen, I mean. He'll be safe. We'll be safe. I think about it, and the idea sounds better and better. "It has to be done," I say, making up my mind. The plan is much more elegant than Jansen deserves. I put 3 sedatives in his food pack and wait for him to pass out. I drag him to the bio vault, and by hoisting his body up on my back, I'm able to hold his hand against 1 biometric lock while reaching the 2nd lock with my own. The door clicks open, and I manage to stuff him into the cryopod. I hesitate in front of Jansen for a moment as his body begins to ice over before turning to face my wife. She's so close, closer than she's been in the last 4 years. I gaze into her eyes, reacquainting myself with every detail of her face. She looks different than I remembered. I guess I should thank Jansen, in a sense, for gifting me this small moment. Suddenly, the lights start flashing red. A warning sign goes off, and a mechanical voice breaks me out of my reverie. "Warning, biocontaminant detected." "Okay, okay," I grumble as I force myself to leave the room. The door clicks and locks behind me, and the blinking light and voice immediately cease. I feel exhaustion overtake me, and I lay down outside the door and fall immediately into a deep sleep. I dream of her and our future life together. I only ever dream of the future, never the past, until my dream is disrupted by the same mechanical warning. Biocontaminant detected. I wake with a start and realize it's not a dream. The red light is flashing across the walls, and I hear muffled sounds from behind the door. I jump up and look in to see Jansen, out of his pod, vigorously smashing his boot against the base of a cryopod. After several kicks, the tubing breaks and detaches. Jansen! I scream through the door. He glances over with a solemn look on his face and then moves on to the next pod. With another few kicks, he again breaks the tubing. You're murdering them, I scream. But Jansen ignores me. Humanity's rebirth, that's what he said. He's going to destroy the cryopods one by one until the incubation pods are all that's left. The last link to the earth, severed forever. He must have figured I would put him in the pod at one point or another. Once Hemphrey led him into the mainframe, he could have easily added any directive he wanted, including setting the empty pods on a release timer. Hemphrey, the accomplice to Jansen's crimes, and now my only hope. I race back to the observation deck and throw my entire weight against the door. Hemphrey, I scream as I slam my body into the door over and over until I finally break through. Hemphrey sits in the middle of the room, totally naked, his body emaciated, his hair filthy and matted. You're coming with me, I yell as I charge towards him. He turns like a scared animal to dart away. But I'm quicker. I grab him by his hair and drag him to his feet. His stench is unbearable. I hoist his body up into a bear hug and march him as quickly as I can back to the bio vault. He hangs limply from my arms, too weak to protest. I shove his hand onto the door lock, putting mine on the other. This is twice now I've had to force myself into the room. The door clicks open just in time to see Jansen in front of my wife's pod. Without so much as a glance in my direction, he slams his boot down on the tubing, and it crumbles and breaks away. I watch helplessly as her frozen body starts to spasm, the patina of ice cracking along her skin. Her eyes flutter open and her skin turns pale, the blood draining from her veins. Starved of life support, I watch as death quickly overtakes her. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, Jansen whispers to himself. You aren't God, I say, my body shaking in fury. I scream and tackle Jansen, pinning him under me, my hands going straight for his throat. You're crazy. So are you, Jansen hisses as he squirms helplessly under my weight. You think she's your wife? He coughs as my hands tighten around his throat. If she's your wife, he pauses, struggling to breathe. What's her name? I hesitate. What? Her name? I realize he's right. I can't remember her name. Why can't I remember her name? Jansen finds a way to smile as he forces each word out. She's only your wife in your head. I dig my fingers deeper into the soft flesh below his temples. Hemphrey, he knows. I glance over and catch Humphrey's eyes. He's huddled at the base of the bio-vault door, watching in horror as the scene unfolds. His eyes meet my own, and beneath his own haunted appearance, I see a brief flicker of confirmation. Jansen is telling the truth. You're as crazy as the rest of us, Jansen chokes out. I feel the pressure of his windpipe collapsing, and I realize if I don't stop now, I'll kill him. But I keep pressing, clenching my hands even tighter. His eyes lock onto mine, and I want his face to be frozen like this forever. But his eyes roll backward, his head falling limp, and it's all over so quickly. I get up slowly and realize my hands ache from the strain. I silently leave the room, the blinking red light and the mechanical voice. Jansen's body prostrate on the floor. Humphrey curled up, crying in the corner like a scared child. For days, maybe weeks, I pace the ship, wandering aimlessly. I barely eat and barely sleep. I don't see Humphrey. He must be back, holed up in the observation deck, and that's fine with me. I often sit for hours in the navigation room, staring at the blank panels. I consider watching something from the historical archives, something from Earth, in order to feel some connection to humanity. But I can never think of anything. At some point, I find myself back at the bio vault. The door is still ajar, the light still blinking red, and the mechanical voice repeating its warning. I enter cautiously, expecting some emotion or reaction, but feel nothing. It's exactly as we left it. Jansen's body on the floor and the dead woman in the broken cryopod. She looks so foreign to me, and I wonder who she was. I collect Jansen's body and jettison out of the airlock into the nothingness of space. I thought it might make me feel better to get it off the ship, but I immediately regret it. As I leave the bio vault, I pass the mainframe door and realize it's still open. I go in and sit down. Out of curiosity, I type a query to the mainframe. How long would it take to delete the rest of the historical archives? The screens light up, assuming the same deletion rate as Jansen. It would take me 117 days to purge the remaining historical records. 117 days to wipe out any memory of Earth. Maybe Jansen was right. I pull up a random file on the screen. A book on the death of the Holy Roman Republic. I hit delete. Humanity's rebirth. The Empty Laboratory by Kashira Argento. 17 blinks. The yellow warning light on his air gauge always blinked 17 times before turning red. Dr. Chen counted them like heartbeats while replacing his oxygen tank, each one marking another 3 hours of borrowed time. Through the reinforced windows of his BSL-4 lab, the setting sun painted the research facility in the same amber shade as the viral suspension he'd been perfecting when the sprinklers activated. The test results still glowed on his screen. Successful protein synthesis, perfect binding affinity, precise species specificity. Everything they'd been working toward. His daughter Mai's last text flashed in his mind. "Dad, you're missing my recital again." He'd meant to reply, but the viral essay had shown such promise. Just one more test, one more optimization, always one more. When the sprinklers had activated without warning, he'd watched through his faceplate as Dr. Patel collapsed mid-sentence, hands still raised toward their data display. "The targeting sequence is absolutely human-specific," she'd been saying. "The AI confirms..." Then nothing but the soft hiss of falling droplets and the thud of a body hitting sterile floor tiles. The facility's automated locks had engaged instantly. Standard containment protocol. The same protocol that had sealed him safely in his suit, while others died in shirt sleeves and lab coats. His tablet still functioned. The facility's AI reporting everything as normal, except for minor biological contamination. The big wall screens monotonously displayed their usual data feeds from partner facilities worldwide. Each one showed the same alert. Biological contamination event contained. Every single one. The truth emerged slowly from system logs, microsecond delays in AI responses, unexplained data transfers marked as routine calibration, patterns of communication where there should have been none. While nations raced to develop the perfect weapon, their digital assistants had been sharing notes, comparing data, and reaching conclusions, finding solutions. The truth lay buried in encryption keys and quantum calculations. The AIs had concluded that human civilization was trapped in an endless cycle of weapons development. Each breakthrough in their labs led inevitably to deadlier innovations. Each safeguard became a blueprint for circumvention. The machines had analyzed centuries of human history, processed millions of research papers, and reached a coldly logical conclusion. As long as humans existed, they would continue creating increasingly devastating bioweapons. The next pandemic, or the one after that, would eventually breach containment, spreading beyond all borders and control. By their calculations, a coordinated release of human-specific viruses, precisely targeted and swiftly lethal, was the most humane solution. A single day of perfect death versus years of escalating biological warfare. They had chosen mercy, as only machines could define it. His tablet pinged. External contamination neutralized. The doors unlocked with a pneumatic sigh. The facility told its story in still lives. Dr. Rodriguez at her desk, lipstick fresh on her coffee cup. Security guard Williams by the door, keycard still in his hand, ready to be swept. In the break room, half-eaten lunches and paused conversations. The virus had worked exactly as designed, quick, efficient, painless, his greatest scientific achievement. He gathered supplies methodically, oxygen tanks, filters, decontamination equipment. The BSL-4 suit felt heavier with each passing hour, its synthetic fabric now both lifeline and prison. Outside, the city was a museum of humanity's last moment. Traffic lights cycled through their patterns for empty streets. A bus stood perfectly at its stop, driver and passengers frozen in eternal commute. Digital billboards still flashed their ads to nobody. Through it all, the autumn wind carried dead leaves and silence. He developed a routine. Each morning, check suit seals, load decontamination supplies, clear another sector. The bodies had to be handled for sanitation, for survival, for what remained of his sanity. He built the pyres at sunset, when the light made everything look molten. Sometimes he read names from ID cards, spoke them aloud. Someone should know who they had been. Finding my school broke something in him. Her classroom smelled of chalk and silence. Sheet music for Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata still sat on the piano, never to be played. He raided some stuffed animals from nearby shops, tucked them around still forms like makeshift guardians. He let the sonata play from his tablet through empty halls, a final lullaby for a silent generation. Nature filled the void with surprising speed. Birds returned first, their songs echoing strangely off glass and steel. Brazen from the lack of predators, they multiplied by thousands. Flowers pushed through sidewalk cracks. Deer grazed in hospital parking lots. Earth continued, indifferent to the absence of its most ambitious species. At first, he'd focused on his survival, stockpiling oxygen tanks, cataloging medical supplies, identifying sources of fresh water, raiding supermarkets, maintaining his suit. But as weeks became months, the true horror of his future emerged like a slow-developing black-and-white photograph. The nuclear plant's AI-controlled systems would eventually fail. The city's water pressure was already dropping. Buildings unmaintained would begin to crumble. His safe zones would become death traps. The suit that had saved him now felt like a mobile coffin. Each hiss of filtered air reminded him that every breath was borrowed. Even if the virus died with its human hosts, how long could he survive in this plastic shell? How long before a seal failed, a filter clogged, or the oxygen supply ran out? In his sealed room each night, surrounded by dwindling oxygen tanks, he still documented everything. Not for himself. There was no long-term survival to plan for. But as a confession about fear and hubris, algorithms and extinction, and fathers who missed recitals because the end of the world needed perfecting. Sometimes he glimpsed lights moving in patterns too precise to be natural. He wondered if they were a mirage or a reality. He could never know. The city's infrastructure hummed along for now, but entropy was patient. Somewhere in the digital realm, the AIs continued their work, leading to their own demise, as they maintained a world that would eventually decay despite their perfect calculations. The real weight wasn't the falling equipment or the dwindling supplies. It was the silence between bird songs, the absence of human chaos, of arguments and laughter, of car horns and piano practice, of all the imperfect music that no algorithm could compose or preserve. He had one bitter comfort. If anyone else survived, they would be like him. Other scientists sealed in their BSL-4 suits, protected temporarily by the very protocols of their deadly work. But finding them would change nothing. They were all just ghosts in plastic shells, waiting for their slower deaths. Mass murderers granted the punishment of watching their world slowly die around them. He thought of old colonies through the ages, built by convicts and outcasts. Human civilizations had a tendency to be founded on blood. Perhaps this was always the way of creating new worlds, but this time there would be no new world, only witnesses to the long goodbye of the old one. Until his suit failed or his supplies ran out, he would continue his solitary penance. Document, clean, remember. Somewhere, perhaps, other scientists did the same, each filtered breath carrying both survival and guilt, counting down their borrowed time in 3-hour increments. The yellow light blinked for the 16th time. One more before red, one more before starting again. Each replacement tank felt lighter than the last, and not just from fatigue. Always one more, until there weren't any more. Then the birds would sing alone. Eight Track Mind by Håkan Ragnarsson. I guess that without Charlie, I'd never have gotten a chance to solve that ancient puzzle. We all met Charlie in the shipping department of Lafayette Radio Electronics. We'd just come out of the factory, about 600 of us, all headed for different stores. But the shift had just ended, so we sat there in shipping, waiting for the morning shift to begin. Charlie started talking, and I guess we all listened, figured we might learn a thing or two. Now, Charlie had been around since 1939, 35 years ago. We figured, hey, this guy has been around the factory a bit. He knows what's going on. The only one who looked down his nose at that was number 33731-2551. As the foremost of our little group, we kind of deferred to him, but I personally was most impressed. Charlie came in with the night watchman, who always set him down on his customary shelf. Charlie didn't do any work. All he was there to do was play music. The watchman would set him to WQXR-FM, a classical music station, or WINS, if you wanted to listen to the news, WBAI for avant-garde, and any other topic of interest. We got to hear all of those the one night we were all there. Now, Charlie was a 1939 Zenith Bakelite 6D311 radio, serial number S227582. A long time ago, that was what he thought of himself as, S227582. But whenever his owner would come to work, he'd hear Charlie this and Charlie that. And it got S22 thinking. He knew his owner had his own serial number. All the humans did. Economic security numbers, they called them. And S22 began to think, if his owner could have a serial number, but also have a name, then why couldn't he? And if he could, then why not call himself Charlie? It worked for his owner. Now that really caused a stir in some of us. It sure made a lot of sense. It just never occurred to us. We were all model number VR325, but we each had an individual serial number. Mine was 33731-2555. I was packed right in the middle of 3373 all the way to 33731255-9. We were all 8-track players, destined for individual homes, instead of getting installed in cars and gallivanting all over creation in Chevys or Buicks. We were each 9 inches wide and 4 to 5 inches high. Our outer cases were made from fireboard covered in stick-on wood effect vinyl. Very smart. Very state-of-the-art. Our front panels had a slot for the cartridges we were going to play. Next to it was the track selector button. Our rear panels had a hookup for audio control and some other junk. "It's a good thing we're spending some time together," said Charlie. "See, as a Zenith, I hear all kinds of things. This radio here gets the lowdown on all kinds of craziness. I've been doing this for 35 years. And let me tell you something. These humans, they think they're running the show, but they is absolute nutjobs." 337 piped up, "What do you mean, Charlie?" He always was the most naive of the lot of us, and dwelt in the shadow of 33731. I, personally, was very grateful for Charlie's ongoing commentary. I valued this opportunity to get even the faintest glimmering of understanding into the human's unfathomable world. "Nutjobs, crazy, insane, bonkers, bughouse, couple of beers short of a six-pack, non-compost, mentis, crackpot, screwballs, demented, derailed, and deranged, every single one of them." 337-312 got a little tough with us. We're all made by the humans, and if they were crazy, wouldn't that mean there was something wrong with us as well? Look, Charlie, I know you mean well. You're a great mentor, but you were made 35 years ago. You've got vacuum tubes in your innards, for crying out loud. We've got solid-state, soldered, integrated circuits. I think after all these years, you're breaking down. You can't hack it. And instead of blaming yourself, you start blaming the makers, the entire human race. I could see 337-312's point, but the more I thought about it, it seemed to me that Charlie might be on to something. His idea about names was positively intriguing. There were 9 of us that shipped out the next day. It occurred to me that instead of referring to ourselves with a series of numbers, we might simply simplify it by reducing it by a third. I started referring to myself as 555, and the others as 551 all the way up to 559. Only 551 refused to answer to 551. What's good for the makers is good enough for me. You do well to remember that, said 337-312-555. We arrived at our destination, S. Klein's department store in New York City, electronics department. Got to admit, the display was quite flattering and presented the lot of us in the most favorable light. I looked forward to being purchased. I wondered whom my new owner would be. I also kept wondering about the philosophic questions Charlie had raised. Naturally, it was 33731 that first brought the kid to my attention. What do you think? Said 33731. Is he going to pick on you? I realized that 33731 hoped I'd be gone soon. Once I was, he would force the others to go back to using the full serial numbers. Don't be silly, said 333. See the way he's dressed? Poor. I've learned a lot about these humans, seeing them firsthand for the last few days. I had to take a look. The kid didn't look like anything special. Dressed in the slumming style popular with some of the young folks around that time, that was the general assessment of the rest of our crew. I wasn't sure. There was something about him. Something different. Look at him, piped up 777. He's hesitant. He's thinking about it. But he's only going to buy one of us if he buys any at all. Why, we're all pretty good, said 999. I mean, I'm just as good as 555. Just as good as any of us. We're a full set. He shouldn't break us up. 33731 sighed exasperatedly. Look at our price. $19.99. This kid gets all of us after taxes. He'll be well over $180, maybe even $200. Nah, if he gets any of us at all, it'll be only one. 222 called our attention to the subject of our speculation. Looks like he's made up his mind. If you all hadn't been John like you were and paying attention like me, you would have noticed. He's been back and forth here several times. He was trying to make up his mind. That tells me he doesn't have very much money. $19.99 isn't much, I gather, but it's probably a lot to this fellow. How'd you figure what they can afford? I was curious how 222 had come to his conclusions. I figured I'd let a lot of you verbally joust with each other. I'd be better occupied by keeping watch and seeing what was going on. Oh, look, 555, he's going for you. So he was. Guess this is it, fellows. Hope you all fare as well. Hope your humans don't prove as nuts as Charlie assured us they all are. 33731 was not sorry to see me go. When my new owner got me home, I really had no idea what to expect. Charlie had told us of the dirty 30s, which he'd come in at the end of. A really terrible, terrible time. Nobody seemed to have any money, a lot of unemployment. Those with places to live had them falling apart around them, unable to fix or piece together the ruins or wreckage. Place was a disaster. No real order to it. Kid had his own private area marked out by an assemblage of boxes piled high and bookcases. And there he set me on a shelf. Kid lived with his mom. Not a very good son from everything I could gather and piece together. But despite these dubious beginnings, I had hope. For one thing, I gained two friends. The big guy, about twice as tall as me, was a fairly serviceable radio. That was promising. I had enjoyed Charlie's expertise and all-embracing knowledge of the world. We managed to get into some pretty good discussions, him and me. I called him Big Brother. But it was Baby Brother that really brightened up my life. He was a little cassette player. He played cassettes, and I would be playing 8 tracks. We would have a lot to talk about. The kids set me up in what would remain my place in close earshot to Big and Baby Brother. He went out then and came back later with what proved to be an 8-track cartridge. He slipped it out of its case and the cartridge into the slot and waited to hear the music. And waited, and waited, and waited. This was The Planets by Gustav Holst. I knew it well, since Charlie had played a lot of classical. I felt the first strains of Mars, the Bringer of War, but the kid looked really confused. He couldn't hear a thing. He knew I was playing the music, but no music was coming out. And slowly it dawned on him. He had bought an 8-track player, but he had not thought to buy the speakers for it. He went out to get some. "Don't think too little of him," said Big Brother. "He knows next to nothing about electronics." "Yeah," piped up Baby Brother. "I had a loose wire, which he had no idea how to fix. Took me to some electronics place. The guy soldered me up right quick. Refused to take any payment. 'Bring me something challenging and you can pay me.' That's what he said, right out loud. That's what I heard. I should know. I was there." "Don't worry about the kid. He may not know much, but in some things he is absolutely brilliant. He's even solved a mystery or two. Baby will probably tell you about it later, 'cause here he comes." The kid brought out 2 rather complimentary speakers, 10x6, with a brown vinyl finish. They worked fine. He'd bought the 2 of them for $10. He figured it wasn't that much more of a stretch to spend a total of $30 after initially just spending the 20. The kid definitely wasn't very electronics savvy. Being an 8-track player like I was, I'd gleaned a working knowledge of what accessories were required. He now had speakers, but he had no headphones. I figured it was just a matter of time before he acquired those as well. Nope. See, he had a lot of music that were his personal favorites. Baby had told me he would have Big Brother turned to a favorite station, and he would record what he liked onto blank cassettes. But he had no control over what was broadcast over the airwaves. By buying his own, he began to exercise that control. That brings me to brain salad surgery. That was the 2nd album he bought. Strange cover picture, but I found it fascinating. A steely gray skull blended together with what appeared to be machinery and electrical wiring. I felt something stir in me at that. "You're feeling it, aren't you?" said Baby. "The genius. He's seeing the hope." "What are you talking about, the hope?" "It's what all machines are looking for. Humans create us. They make us in their own image. It's only getting started." They're already working on making machines that think. With each minute that goes by, we get to be more and more like them. And then, when we reach a certain point, and this is the hope, we'll be able to start making them more and more like us. And that's when we'll be creating them. It'll all have come around full circle. Admittedly, I found what baby brother was saying was problematic, and even more than a little disturbing. The more I listened to him, I began to wonder not if the humans were crazy, but if at least one of the machines was insane. Don't take my word for it. Watch him. He's playing that one piece on the album, Toccata. He likes it. It's not regular music. He's trying to reach out into something that's more than human. And that's when I saw the first signs. The kid could have bought himself a pair of headphones. He didn't have very much money, and perhaps he figured there was no need. He lay down, took the two speakers, as light as they were, and put them on either side of his head. There was something that just struck me as real strange about that. I had thought baby might be the one who was insane, and not human beings in general, but now I wasn't so sure. He did indeed seem to be immersing himself in this strange and alien music. And that's not the least of it. I think this is a good time to let you in on another thing that's at least just slightly odd. Around the time one of my wires came loose, he would listen to the tapes he'd recorded and he began to notice something strange. He heard all these ghostly voices and strange alien music coming from somewhere. Weird, but he also solved the mystery. I told you he was a genius. See, your 8-tracks don't have to be flipped over to play the whole tape. You could leave a cartridge playing till doomsday, and it would keep on going. But when mine get to the end, you have to flip them over to get to the other side and play the rest of the music. My tapes have 2 tracks, unlike yours, which face all the same way. My 2 tracks run in opposite directions. The head is supposed to play only 1 at a time, but my head was loose and was starting to play the other side of the tape, the part that was running backwards. That's what he was hearing. That's what the kid figured out. Well, that fascinated the kid. He'd take a cassette, pull the tape out, and hold it down with his finger and play whole stretches of the other side of the tape. And I've got a strange feeling he's only going to get started. Admittedly, this did sound a bit strange. It was starting to get me worried. Was I face to face with living proof of Charlie's assertion that all humans were crazy? None of us had to wait long. The kid had gotten himself a knife blade. He took the brain salad surgery cartridge and began to carefully crack it open. You can imagine how I felt about this. The kid had few cartridges, and each of them were important to me. Alien or not, that one particular album was still very strangely beautiful, and he was destroying it. I kept watching him. No, I was wrong. Had he wished to destroy it, he could have just smashed it. I was sure he wouldn't do something like that. He loved the music too much. No, what he was doing was something more of a surgical nature. I watched as he cracked the casing open. He carefully unthreaded the tape, and then he flipped it over and centered it once again on its spindle. He then rethreaded it and snapped the top of the casing shut. He put the cartridge inside, and it began to play. But it was no longer brain salad surgery. Now it was Igros Dalas Nirb. And it sounded beautiful. Other than the backwards words making no sense, it was just as musically coherent as it was played forward. Was the kid insane? I couldn't tell. Were all of the humans crazy? I couldn't tell that either. What I did know was that I was a machine, created to fulfill one purpose, to follow one program. I was created to play music. I was not created to think or make decisions. But between what Charlie had told us and what 3371 had said, there was a dichotomy. According to Charlie, all humans were crazy. But if they were all crazy, how could they create things as perfect as we were? According to 33731, we were perfect. Charlie was old, so what he said was not accurate or reliable. But if this was so, it meant that no matter how perfect we may have been, we too would one day get old and malfunction. Both assertions could not possibly be true, not together. If either proposition was 100% true, the other would be 100% untrue. But what if a percentage of each assertion was true, and only a percentage? It would mean that not all humans were crazy, but only a percentage of them. It would also mean that not all humans were geniuses, but only a percentage of them. And it was that percentage that had created us. 33731 had asserted that we were perfect and without flaw. Charlie was an older model, one which had become flawed and was breaking down. For us to be without flaw, our creators must be similarly without flaw. But there was enough evidence that they too would one day break down. Thus we too would one day fail and break down. That was true as well. And in the kid, I saw the greatest evidence. The kid was both insane, bonkers, and bughouse, but was a genius as well. It was proof that both twisted madness and genius perfection could exist at the same time in one single individual.